Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, very much from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, December 9th, 2020. United Nations officials say Sudan's transitional government needs support.
Sudan is at a critical juncture. It can move forward decisively in its transition, but that progress can still be derailed by the many challenges it faces.
And activists in Sudan are calling on authorities to enact laws that protect women's rights.
The reality is there is lack of regulation in the country. There is a social stigma towards victims of violence, and there is lack of community protection and support for women who fall victims of violence.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Under-Secretary General for Political and Peace-Building Affairs says Sudan is at a critical point in its transition to democracy. He says the country needs political and economic support in order to overcome challenges threatening to derail the transitional government. As Nabil Biagio reports from Washington, this month marks 2 years anniversary of the revolution that kicked out former President Omar al-Bashir.
At a briefing to the UN Security Council yesterday, Rosemary DiCarlo said Sudan is at a key stage of its transition to democracy and needs support from the international community.
Sudan is at a critical juncture. It can move forward decisively in its transition, but that progress can still be derailed by the many challenges it faces. It is incumbent on all of us to support Sudan in its efforts to achieve democratic governance, economic prosperity, and an inclusive society for all Sudanese.
December 19 will be the second anniversary of the start of nationwide protests that led to the military removing President Bashir from power in April 2019. But DiCarlo says Sudan is still experiencing political division and an economic decline due to a number of reasons.
Demonstrations continue to occur intermittently across the country because of the economic crisis, demands for government reform, and rejection of the amendments to the constitutional document. Some have been accompanied by loss of life and injuries. The COVID-19 pandemic has further aggravated the humanitarian needs, also driven by severe flooding, intercommunal violence, and prolonged displacement.
DiCarlo also says the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region, which has prompted tens of thousands of Ethiopian refugees to stream into neighboring Sudan, has strained Sudan's economy and its response capacity. She says despite a peace agreement signed between Sudan's transitional government and a rebel coalition, and a number of political and legal reforms already enacted, the economic crisis in Sudan threatens to undermine the transition.
The dire economic situation continues to cast a dark and long shadow over all these efforts. COVID-19 restrictions, including the five-month shutdown to prevent its spread, resulted in a severe decline in economic activity.
Sudan's inflation rate stood at 229% in October, and the country is experiencing a budget deficit of some $250 million a month, according to DiCarlo.
It is critical that the international community continue supporting Sudan's economic recovery through funding of the Basic Income Cash Transfer Program, known as the Family Support Program, intended to mitigate the social impact of the transitional government's economic reform agenda. I welcome once again the intention of the United States to rescind Sudan's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism, a change that will facilitate the country's access to critical international financial assistance.
Sudan is expecting American lawmakers to pass bipartisan legislation to remove the country from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism and restore Sudan's sovereign immunity, possibly as soon as this month. Sudan was placed on the list in 1993 after hosting Osama bin Laden and other wanted militants. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Some Sudanese activists are calling on the law enforcement agencies in the country to implement laws and regulations that protect the rights of women and children in Sudan. One woman activist says despite some significant reforms in the country's laws to protect the rights of Sudanese, women continue to experience various types of violence. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Nahed Jabrallah is a founder of Sudan's SIMA Center for Training and Protection of Women and Children's Rights, a non-profit organization that aims to protect women and children and provide support to women and girls in situations of violence and social aggression. Jabrallah says Sudanese women across the country still experience several types of violence, including sexual and domestic violence. Speaking on the sidelines of a two-day workshop on protecting women in Khartoum on Tuesday, Jabrallah said some forms of violence include forced and early marriages. As Sudanese women commemorate the 16 days of activism, Jabrallah says many communities across the country are still in denial about women's rights, which hinders efforts to eliminate violence against women.
The reality is there is lack of regulation in the country. There is a social stigma towards victims of violence, and there is lack of community protection and support for women who fall victims of violence. We need the support of all levels to prevent the violence and provide essential support to victims.
Jabrallah says Sudanese should take advantage of the current change in the legislature to initiate laws that protect women's rights and hold violators accountable. She says law enforcement agencies are still weak and their personnel are not well trained to respond to cases of sexual abuse and domestic violence.
We need to see into it that victims are able to access justice easily. Law enforcement institutions such as police, judiciary, public attorney offices, and lawyers are truly strengthened to offer a quick access to justice process.
Sudanese women's advocate Umaima Abdul Wahab says after 3 decades of Islamic Sharia law under the leadership of Ostad President Omar al-Bashir, many communities are not prepared to deal with the legislative changes that protect women and children. Abdul Wahab says as Sudan joins the international community and adopts other rights charters, it is important that the government do more to regulate local laws that correspond to international standard, particularly those regarding women's rights.
We are keen to fulfill our commitment to regional and international community regarding human rights charter and the elimination of all forms of violence against women. It requires countries to respond to prevent all violence against women, especially for women in armed conflict.
Aji Fatou, the UN Women Country Director for Sudan, says taking adequate measures to work towards fighting violence against women and girls is the best way to promote not only a fair society, but economy of the country. She says UN Women hopes to obtain the full support of the Sudanese government institutions to support the fight against violence against women in Sudan.
It's important that our different countries, including Sudan, of course, adopt laws to fight violence against women, and mainly also to promote gender equality. But on top of adoption of laws, we will need social transformation that will raise awareness of women, men, boys and girls on the aspect of social inequalities that are linking to violence against women and girls.
Sudan's transitional government scrapped the controversial Public Order Act in November last year after mounting pressure from Sudanese women's rights groups. The government also criminalized the practice of female genital mutilation in May of this year. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Malawi has seen a drop in confirmed COVID-19 infections despite increasing number of people ignoring rules on social distancing, wearing masks and washing hands. Malawi's government credits their early enforcement of measures for the drop, but some health experts argue the real reason is less testing. As Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, some worry the growing complacency could lead to second wave of the virus.
Juliet Masamba, a secondary school in Indilande Township. stopped wearing a face mask in September after Malawi's government reopened the schools and airports and lifted restrictions on social gatherings. She says this is because the COVID-19 cases here in Malawi are going down. Even the statistics of those who are dying of the disease are not threatening. This makes me believe that the outbreak is gone and cannot come back. Malawi has for the past 3 months registered a dramatic drop in coronavirus infections from a total of 1,065 active cases on October 3rd. The country's total caseload has dropped to just 45 as of December 7. More than 5,000 people have recovered, while the death toll stands at 185. New confirmed cases are now ranging between 1 and 4 per day. Sometimes days pass without a recorded infection. Maziko Matemba, who heads Malawi's Health and Rights Education Program, attributes the drop in new infections to declining COVID-19 testing.
Our testing capabilities is not as high as we'd expect by now, because we haven't even hit 50,000 or 100,000. By now, it should have maybe 1 million people tested, but you know, our testing is targeted.
Malawi, with a population of 18 million, is currently only testing those with COVID-19 symptoms, largely because of shortage of testing kits. Dr. Charles Mansambo is principal secretary in the Ministry of Health. Dr. Mansambo says the testing drop is because of the government's early enforcement of measures like closing schools, restricting public gatherings, and mandating people to wear face masks in public places. But he says he worries about growing complacency in Malawi.
You know, that's a big concern. We're not out of the woods yet. I mean, we still have COVID around, and we have to follow all the public health measures that we put in place. We've seen that people have relapsed, which is very dangerous for us. We still have the virus around, and it's got that potential of spreading very quickly, and we cannot afford a second wave.
Meantime, Malawi's government has intensified its campaign to remind people on the need to adhere to all COVID-19 preventive measures like hand washing, observing social distancing, and wearing face coverings. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the effects of COVID-19 on journalism. That story is lined up for you after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where do you get your health advice from?
Sometimes I get my health advice from my grandmother, who is at home. When I'm sick that I can't control myself, she'll help.
I get my health advice from my friend, colleague, who live together. Well, those who know about, those who have been experienced more problems about health, they don't advise me through phone. We talk, we chat, discuss everything.
My dad, because my dad is a doctor.
I'd say I get my health advice from various places. The internet, my parents, because I have, my mother is a nurse.
My health advice, I get it on the internet. If I need something on how to deal with obesity, I get it on the internet. Anything I need pertaining to health advice is on the internet.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Hundreds of supporters of Cameroon opposition leader Maurice Kamto have gathered at his home after his month-long de facto house arrest suddenly ended. Heavily armed police stationed at his home since September 22nd left on Tuesday, but authorities are giving no explanation. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Maurice Kamto's supporters flocked to his home after heavily armed police left the opposition leader's house Tuesday night, ending a months-long de facto house arrest. Cameroon authorities gave no immediate explanation for why police left or if Kamto would face any charges from the September protest that prompted the detention. Among the hundreds of Kamto supporters is 19-year-old Ernestine Nanga, who says she is anxious to see him free.
When I heard that the police left the house of our political leader Maurice Kamto, I came here to know if our political leader Maurice Kamto is in good heart, to know the plan he has for our country. Thirdly, I want to hear from him. I want him to address us Cameroonians.
Christopher Ndong is Secretary General of Kamto's Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party. He says the opposition leader is in good health and will be addressing his supporters at what he calls an appropriate moment. Ndong called on the government to release some 130 Kamto supporters and party officials who were among hundreds arrested in September for rebellion and illegal assembly.
We are looking forward for them to release the leaders of the executive organs and many others who make this government know that there should be meaningful and true democracy, that political parties should be free to hold meetings, manifestation, associate with other political parties, create coalition, and that the electoral system be revised and then an electoral code done which will be suitable for everybody.
In a press release late Tuesday, government spokesman René Emmanuel Sadi said those arrested would face the law. Sadi said they are accused of rebellion, attempted revolution, and illegal assembly for a September 22 protest against President Paul Biya and holding regional elections. Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says Cameroon's first regional elections held Sunday shows that people trust Biya and his government.
Everyone knows that in democracy, political or Republican legitimacy is acquired through the ballot box. Refusing to participate in elections and claiming to defend the interests of Cameroonians without any elective mandate is a scheme that cannot work in Cameroon. We will not allow that to happen.
The opposition argues election laws favor the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement Party and Biya, who has been in power for nearly four decades. In January 2019, authorities detained Kamto and 200 of his supporters for insisting that Biya stole the 2018 presidential election from him. International pressure led Biya to pardon Kamto after he'd spent 9 months in prison. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A report by the European Broadcasting Union finds the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated change in public service media that fundamentally affects the quality of journalism in both positive and negative ways. The EBU report, Fast Forward, Public Service Journalism in the Viral Age, is being launched on the eve of a two-day World Press Freedom Conference co-sponsored by UNESCO and the Netherlands. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A complex picture emerges from interviews with 20 news leaders across Europe regarding the lasting impacts of the coronavirus crisis on public broadcast journalism. Head of news at EBU, Liz Corbin, says the pandemic hit the fast-forward button on changes, which already were in progress. She says ideas were catapulted into reality faster than could have been imagined in pre-COVID times.
And the global pandemic made people desperate for good quality information.
audiences turned in huge numbers to public service journalism providers. And in this viral age, where the spread of fake news is perhaps the only thing keeping pace with COVID, there has been innovation and creativity.
At the beginning of the pandemic, the report finds people's trust in public service media and in government was high. During this period, it says the government was supportive of the role the media were playing in distributing vital information. But when newsrooms became more critical of government's response to COVID-19, the relationship between the two institutions began to sour. Co-author of the report, Mikey Olich, says attacks by some governments and politicians against the credibility of the media have led to an erosion in public trust of newsmakers. She says threats to media freedoms and attacks targeting public service journalism have increased.
There are conspiracy theories quite abundantly, and there are accusations towards sometimes public service media or different kinds of media. And as these insecurities and the pandemic last longer, people become even more suspicious and fearful. They doubt all official voices and also public service news in that.
Navigating in these unclear waters is not easy. However, the report has several recommendations. It says public service media should always provide trustworthy, reliable information, and online journalism should tailor its reporting to audience needs. It says addressing fake news and being more attentive to undercurrents in society is key in polarized times. It stresses the importance of critical journalism, even when sharing official messages. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A top U.S. counterterrorism official has expressed concern about the deteriorating situation in Mozambique, where an Islamic State-affiliated group has captured territory in the country's northeast. But Ambassador at Large Nathan Sales says a military solution is not the answer. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For 3 years, northern Mozambique has been a hotbed of activity by a shadowy Islamist militant group. Their attacks have led to the displacement of more than 400,000 people and the deaths of more than 2,000 in the Cabo Delgado region. But, as a top U.S. counterterrorism official says, this conflict affects much more than a rural corner of one southern African nation. The conflict has recently spread to neighboring Tanzania, raising the potential of dragging the region into instability and boosting a group with declared ties to the Islamic State. Ambassador-at-Large Nathan Sales, the U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism, recently visited Mozambique and South Africa to see how the U.S. can help, as he said, contain, degrade, and defeat the growing movement. With a situation this complicated, he said, a military solution is not enough. He spoke to reporters Tuesday via teleconference from Washington.
In addition to the security challenges posed by ISIS actors there, we also have the knock-on consequences from a humanitarian standpoint, with hundreds of thousands of Mozambican citizens fleeing the violence. And so part of the response has to include meeting that humanitarian need. We have to get the security situation under control so that people feel comfortable and safe returning to their homes, returning to their lives. The United States has been very active over the years, and especially recently, in devoting resources to help address the humanitarian situation in Cabo Delgado. And we'll look to continue to do so, partnering not just with government entities, but with NGOs that have access and expertise that we need to rely on.
Alex Vines, director of the Africa program at Chatham House, said there are several reasons the world is paying attention to this small corner of Africa. For one, Cabo Delgado has vast, still untapped oil and gas deposits estimated to be worth $60 billion. Instability has prevented those from being developed. And he adds the militant group is getting bolder, helped by the failures of the Mozambican government.
So there's local grievance, there's real frustration that the Mozambican state, the party of government in particular, has not delivered. So disenfranchised, frustrated young people. And I think also that the impact of the cyclone last year in the far north there, so Cyclone Kenneth, that the poor humanitarian response also drove people into becoming more sympathetic to this insurgency. So it's a mixture of all these things, and there's not one key driver. But what's worrying is that it's also a magnet attracting radical jihadists who have been operational elsewhere, looking at Cabo Delgado as maybe a new potential theater for them. And that's particularly worrying, and hence why a U.S. official has been visiting Mozambique to discuss this issue with the Mozambican authorities.
So what are the outlines of the U.S. plan on that? Sales was vague.
What we need to do is make sure that we in the United States are making available to our Mozambican partners every capability that we have to help them degrade and ultimately defeat that terrorist threat. I think you can expect that these conversations will continue into the future as we look to match American capabilities to Mozambican needs. And of course, we want to work very closely with our partners. Once we have reached a consensus, once we have reached an agreement on what our partnership could look like, the precise contours of what that partnership could look like, I'm sure we'll be in a position to share more information about what that will look like.
The U.S. is not the only outside party trying to intervene. This week, Pope Francis donated $121,000 to support victims of militant attacks in Cabo Delgado. Those funds will be used to build health facilities for the displaced. And Vines noted mercenaries with the shadowy Wagner Group arrived in Mozambique in late 2019 to help Mozambican security forces. Top U.S. military officials have echoed analysts who believe the Wagner Group is closely connected to the Kremlin, a charge Russian officials have denied. Mozambique has also been in talks with Britain and neighboring South Africa for possible support in combating the growing insurgency. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We'll now leave you with the song Chikilimanga by General Paulino. We've been listening to General Paulino with the song Chikilimanga. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm
Sibuta kunyamana, anal bakar bosiku.